Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors. Hello, I'm here today with Gareth Evans from Progressive Equity Research. Hi. I'm sure we've all read a progressive note and benefited from it. Gareth, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
You have a very interesting background. You've, for the last 15 or 20 years, you started off in the pan-European chemical sector.
That's right. Yeah.
And then you moved into tech.
Yeah.
So what a background for where we are today.
It was an unusual way into the sector, but it actually worked quite well because I came into the city from Arthur Andersen into a big American bank called DLJ, where I covered the pan-European chemical sector. And that was a great place to learn, partly because it was a good bank with some really good analysts to learn from, but also because the sector I was looking at, chemicals, was very capital intensive. These are big, old companies applying significant amounts of capital into various market opportunities that they saw. And really, that's what all investing is about at the end of the day. It's an application of capital to investment opportunities. And in an old sector like chemicals, where you're making very big decisions around markets that don't move all that quickly, it was quite easy to see the benefits of getting that right, or the dangers of getting it wrong, or more often the dangers of everyone applying capital in the same area, in the same market opportunity at the same time. And then you suddenly get a flood of capital. And in the chemical sector, that might take 2 or 3 years to show through, because it takes you 3 or 4 years to build an ethylene cracker or whatever it might be. So it's only later you see the problems that flood of capital causes and the excess of capital. So it was a great sector to learn from or to learn in. And I've been trying more recently to apply that return on capital, cost of capital discipline to the tech sector, because I think a lot of analysts or investors looking at technology stocks, it's easy to overlook the fact that what they're really doing is taking generally other people's capital and they're investing it in an opportunity around a particular segment or a particular space. And that's exactly the same as it was in the chemical sector and every other sector. You're applying capital to an opportunity. Only with technology stocks, you're not building a factory or some kind of chemical plant. You're hiring developers or tech specialists, or you're building some kind of software platform, and you're making it available to a marketplace, either in a license form or software as a service, whatever it might be. But the dynamics are still the same. The value of the company, the value of the business, is really driven by how much capital you can apply to that segment and the return you can get on that capital. And that's what I enjoy about technology researching or technology investing, is that's still the basis of it. And if you can look for businesses that can, on a continual basis, apply significant amounts of capital and get great returns, that's where, as an investor, you see the most exciting opportunities.
But surely in tech, the return on capital employed is far higher than it would be in the chemicals industry.
It can be, yes, absolutely. If you get it right, it is. Or it can be far lower, it can be negative. You know, you can get, you know, many, many years of no appreciable return on that capital. And that's really the art or the science of trying to analyse tech businesses, is to see through the current performance, to ignore short-term losses perhaps, and look at the market opportunity. And that makes it tougher, because you're not looking at small movements of big dials, you're looking at really, really significant changes that can happen over the course of 6, 12, 18 months. Whereas in the chemical sector, yes, it would take years for these things to show through. And so the tech sector is much shorter term, much faster paced, which makes it more exciting. But then the risk and reward is that much more. You're absolutely right. But I think investors quite often overlook sometimes what you're really seeing is an inability to focus a significant amount of capital. You might get a great return, but if it's a very small niche sector or niche opportunity, there's not much capital you can really apply. There's only so much that you can spend on a particular SaaS platform or whatever it might be, and that market might be limited. And I think what's really exciting about some of the more recent evolutions or developments in the tech space is that they kind of open up the opportunity. So if you look at things like SaaS, mobile, cloud computing, yes, they're great in terms of keeping costs low and providing customers with great products or great user experience. But from an investor perspective or a capital perspective, it means that your capital can be applied in a relatively focused way. But the return on that capital can be massive, because you can make your small, relatively cheaply developed product, you can make it available globally through, you know, all mobile phones around the world on iOS or Google Android. And you can do that very quickly, very efficiently, without much investment. And so the technology platforms that exist, be they mobile, the internet itself, cloud computing, that allows relatively small local developments or investments of capital to drive great returns. And that's where technology works well.
And this is why we're in such a tech sort of golden years.
Yes.
But you came into tech in just before 2000, yeah. So before the dot-com crash, so to speak. So you saw it go yeah. right up and come right back. So it's quite interesting, bearing in mind where yeah. we are today with the markets crashing yeah. back in tech.
Sure.
What's your perspective on that?
No, it's right. I mean, it was a very interesting time to join. And so I joined ABN AMRO in January of 2000, so it was 2 months before the peak in March 2000. And valuations were going up several percent every day. The screens were all green and blue. It was fantastic, huge performance. And then a couple of months later, it all turned down and was downwards for a long time after that. So it was very exciting. I learned a lot of lessons. But probably one of the major ones, which I think, you know, is still relevant, is you mustn't just look at a company's market cap as a real barometer of its value. You can have a very small business, and if it's in a particular niche which is hugely attractive to investors, you get a flood of money in, maybe not particularly intelligent money, drives the valuation to, you know, stratospheric level without any real, you know, there's not much reality to that company. It's either hype or hot air. It taught me a lot of things about looking at these companies and seeing a significant potential dislocation or discrepancy between the real value and what's underlying, the core underlying value of the business, and what might be the current market cap. And yes, in the markets at the moment, we're seeing a significant derating of a number of stocks. But I don't think that should distract people from doing the day job, trying to look at long-term genuine value creation. Because some of these companies, some of the stocks which are falling dramatically at the moment, they've probably got really strong underlying business positions in great structural growth markets with global opportunity. And those are the ones that I think investors shouldn't lose sight of that just because the share price falls. Because yes, often, and certainly in the dot-com boom, valuations were distorted massively in an upwards direction. But sometimes sentiment goes too far the other way, and investors will run away from stocks, or they'll panic. And then that's where the opportunities might lie in terms of finding companies which are maybe overlooked or have been oversold, because people aren't prepared to look through the short-term, you know, loss-making period or whatever it might be, before the company can really continually benefit from the capital that they've built up, or the platforms that they've evolved.
But where do we start with valuing these companies? If I'm thinking of one, and I'm not going to name names, but this has got a 1 billion market cap. It's got turnover of about 53 million, and it's got losses of minus 19 million. How do you value that?
It is. It's so hard. And I think a lot of these stocks, the only way you can really justify these sorts of valuations is by genuinely mapping out and trying to understand the long-term opportunity. And you need to do that in a fairly granular way. As analysts, as research analysts, we would try and build multi-year models. So you'd be modelling the financial performance, obviously looking at top line, what sort of market size might there be, what market share can this business gain, or probably safer and better to do it bottom up, rather than saying this is a multi-billion dollar market and if they only take 10%, that's what this might lead to. Probably safer to look at what does one need to assume for them to build that sort of revenue. You know, what's the average revenue per customer? How many customers exist in the world? How many might they genuinely win? How many have they won so far, and how might that grow? Sort of. So I tend to prefer modeling financial performance bottom up. And yes, you're estimating or realistically guessing a number of these variables. But at least if you've built a financial model that works, you can understand how well do they need to perform to be worth, you know, a particular value. So you can work out how many customers they have to win, what pricing they need to achieve, what margin they need to drive from those customers. And then you get into the niceties of things like pricing. You know, what's the market price for this product or service? Is it going up or going down? What are the dynamics there? And you start to build out a potentially viable model, or a sort of a map of how the company might grow. And really, I think that the benefit of financial modelling and valuation in that sense, it isn't so much in just trying to sort of outguess the company or outguess the other analyst or the marketplace. It's more about saying, okay, this is where consensus lies. This is how the company and the other analysts feel performance might evolve over time. What do I need to believe for that to be true? How many customers do they need to win? What sort of pricing has to come through? And that allows you to say, okay, that should generate margins of this amount over this many years, and then you can either do a DCF or, you know, peer group valuation multiples, those sorts of things. So my belief is it really comes down to doing the basics properly and understanding what type of financial performance would this business need to deliver in order to justify the valuation that I'm being asked to pay now. And if the performance, if those metrics in terms of customer numbers and average prices, if those seem sensible and plausible and realistic to you, then maybe you're happy to pay the price. If it seems like they'd have to win an extraordinarily large number of customers at a very high average price with great margins just to justify the current share price, then you might want to be careful.
But when I try and do models, the variables can move the dial so much, and you've got so many variables that I look at models that either I try to do or others have done, and the results come out against the model. They never fit the model. So a model's one way, but how much is gut feel and how much is other factors?
There are, I mean, clearly there's a huge amount of either herd instinct or herd activity and timing. And very often analysts, not me, other analysts, they'll have great ideas or they'll come up with really ultimately correct views on companies being very well positioned or very badly positioned or misrepresenting things. But you're wrong on the timing. So you can have a sell recommendation on a stock, which was spot on, but it takes 2 years to be proven correct. And in those 2 years, the stock might double or treble, which is very painful if you're short a stock or you recommended to hedge funds to short a particular stock. They can lose a lot of money because the rest of the herd hasn't seen those realities. And so, and that's, again, that's a great part of the excitement of the role as an analyst, or the excitement of investing, is trying not just to be right, but to be right at the same time or just before everybody else realizes you're right. And that's the really hard bit, is trying to second guess the behavior of other investors. Because sometimes you'll see companies where fundamentals aren't fantastic or are quite concerning, but everyone's piling into a particular stock. And that can drive a share price very, very strongly, even though the fundamentals perhaps aren't there. And then you miss an opportunity.
And how often do you find your models just wrong?
Models are almost always wrong. You almost never get them exactly right. And often a corporate broker or advisor will work with a company quite closely. So we're, as an analyst, you're working quite closely with the finance director or the CEO of the business. And again, My perspective on that is that the analyst's role is to try and help educate and inform investors, generally institutional investors. And so it's not so much about whether you get your model right or wrong and the niceties of the decimal points. It's more about how do you believe the company needs to perform in order to hit these numbers? Because at the end of the day, the management team are going to have a much better idea than any analyst as to the likely outcome of the business for a particular year or, you know, 2 or 3 year time frame. And so using my model or an analyst model to outguess the management team, you're hostage to fortune. There's no real benefit in trying to do that. They will know better than we will how they think it's going to perform. So modeling, I always see as valuable more in the sense of it allows you to sense check their assumptions and understand, okay, they think the business is going to grow 5%, 10%, 15% next year. Why do they think it's going to grow that? Is that an increase in pricing? Is it more customers doing the same thing? Is it some other dynamic going on within the business? You know, and by building a model, it allows you to have those conversations with management and understand the way they think the business is going to evolve to hit their expectations. And then the next part of the process is to say, okay, so that's the way that management feel things are going to evolve over time. Do I, with my knowledge of the industry, competitors or peers to this company and what's going on more generally, do I believe that that's plausible and that's realistic? And so the benefit or the value in a model is sort of twofold. Firstly, it allows you to better understand the way that people who should know it well, the way that they feel it's going to evolve over time. And secondly, in the industry context or with the sort of the sector view, do I believe those assumptions that one needs to make to get there? And that's sort of that's the second part of the process. That the third step is then taking those views or that analysis and talking to investors or putting it into a research note to describe it to other people. And that's the role of the analyst.
And then what valuation are you going to... You've got all the figures, so it's almost like you're looking current day at what they're going to get in the future because your model's so brilliant. How do you then work out the valuation that you're prepared to pay? You've got a tech company that's going to go to the moon because it's got something that it can scale phenomenally, and there's just no stopping it. How do you value that when it's already very highly valued?
Yeah, it is. It's so hard. I mean, in many ways, it comes down to a sort of the theoretical valuation is that it's the present value of the discounted future cash flow. So you should be trying to model many years out sensible revenue margin assumptions, the working capital, if any, relevant to that, and giving yourself some kind of view of the cash that this business is going to generate for the benefit of the shareholders. The reality is some of those numbers are so far away and so highly variable, it's very, very difficult to have any genuine certainty around them. So you get into the world of percentages, that the how likely is this outcome? Maybe you do some scenario analyses and you say, okay, it could be A, B or C. If it's only A, then it's probably worth this much. If they reach sort of the B level, it might be worth that. Or if it's as great as this scenario over here, then maybe that's worth this. But in each of those sorts of situations, it's probably best to try and look several years out because you want to be modelling a long-term scenario to sort of to see how it might flesh out over time and what might that then be worth. And then you want to try and almost work that back to, okay, if this business really is worth 3 or 5 billion or whatever it is in 5 or 10 years' time, how much should I rationally be prepared to pay for that today? How risky do I think the road is to get to that sort of value such that I'm prepared to pay a high valuation today? And those are the sorts of dynamics that I think analysts generally go through trying to work out their either target prices or recommendations.
And valuations today, we've been working in a very benign interest rate and inflation environment.
Yeah.
Is this now going to have to be factored in? So valuations actually effectively diminish because they've got to compete with, they've got to account for the interest rates and bond yields that are rising.
Yeah, it's funny that the tech sector is quite strange compared to most in the market because the technology sector almost always sits with net cash. So interest rate rises should help interest income for tech businesses. The reality, though, is that you make almost nothing from the interest and that the value of the tech business is driven by the operational performance. And so interest rate changes themselves shouldn't make much difference. It all comes down to sentiment and the psychology of the markets and in particular the customers. So interest rates, as they affect the tech sector, is much more about a sort of second derivative and looking at what the customer base is doing with their procurement decisions or their investments in technology. And if you're selling into a sector which is very interest rate dependent or very consumer dependent, like the retail sector, you might find that that particular customer group is suddenly going to put the brakes on spending. And so as a tech business, it doesn't really affect me in terms of interest rates and my financial structure because I'm insulated from it. I've got my capital. As long as you've raised your capital already, you've got the cash in the bank, you're spending it on developers and platforms and so on, and your product's available to the market. The problem for tech businesses, there are two types of problem. Either you struggle to raise new capital in a more difficult high interest rate environment or where the economy is slowing down, or your customer segment, your customer cohort is less likely to spend on your products. And some companies, some tech businesses can benefit from that. They can actually say, all right, well, the reality is our software is so good, we save our customers money. So as things get difficult or as customers are becoming under increasing pressure to save spending in whatever area it might be, if the technology really does save them money compared to other OPEX or other types of activity that they could take part in, then companies can argue that they will do better in a more difficult economic environment. There are relatively few tech companies that have been able to achieve that or demonstrate that they save their customers enough money that they will spend more on this software or this platform when the world gets tougher. But it does sometimes happen.
So where do you think we're at in the tech cycle?
I think a lot of technology companies have still got a huge way to go. I remember Arm was a great technology company I used to enjoy researching. And SoftBank bought Arm for, at the time, reasons that many people didn't understand, the price they were paying, the lofty valuation that, that SoftBank was prepared to afford the business. But I think that was because they could see the long-term structural opportunity that ARM microprocessors are in so many markets in so many places around the world, and SoftBank saw that. And I think that sort of theme could pervade a lot of technology. I think there's a lot of areas of tech which are really in their infancy. Internet of Things, obviously one of them, big data, artificial intelligence. These are huge technologies that are not going to stop. They need to be, I think society needs to control them and constrain them perhaps in certain areas or certain ways to make sure they don't get out of hand. But the benefits to our lives could be huge. And I really don't think we've really started in many of those areas. There's so much that can yet be done. And the advances or improvements in the hardware and some of the underlying technologies are now just enabling and allowing some of those areas to really start to move forward. So I think there's a long way that we can go with a lot of these areas of tech. And so hopefully that will filter through into investment opportunities in the UK market for some really exciting stocks.
And what are the areas that excite you the most?
Sure. I think there are two areas which I think are particularly of interest. One is to do with automotive vehicle technology and developments there, and the other more about broader changes in the technology landscape, which allows the UK to be, I think, really quite successful or potentially successful. So taking those in turn, the automotive space, there's been a lot of hype and a lot of argument about whether we'll ever get self-driving cars and fully autonomous vehicles. And I think the reality of that may be many years away. But I think there are steps in between now and that endpoint, which are hugely beneficial to society, huge amounts of saving to individuals in terms of reduced numbers of crashes, lives saved, and genuinely important changes in our society that these technologies can and will bring about. And so a lot of those areas of technical improvement, I think they are being done, they should be being done. But most importantly and most interestingly, what we're seeing is the regulators are starting to enable this. And it's quite unusual to see regulators driving and sort of pushing for technology adoption or technological developments. And some of in particular the US regulators, they've come out publicly and said, you might be surprised that we as regulators are driving and pushing for these technology changes, but we can see that every time a car becomes safer, every additional braking feature or small bit of artificial intelligence you put into a vehicle, even though it's still being driven by a person, if you improve that car, you're making it less likely to be involved in a crash. You might save someone's life. And the regulators themselves, they're saying, we see these changes coming through and we want to adopt or adapt technology or to adapt regulation to allow it to happen. And I think that's unusual to get that level of regulatory impetus behind an industry that's already going as fast as it can. So I think there's huge amounts that can be done. There are lots of opportunities for investment and business potential, but also an area where technology can make a real difference to our lives going forward. Secondly, the way that technology has evolved, I think more broadly, is a really full of potential for the UK. Because going back to when I started covering the tech sector in the early 2000s, to be genuinely globally successful, you needed to be very, very large as a corporation and probably American. Most of the successful businesses were in the US. And that was because the capital you needed to apply was so vast and the initial market that you needed to address needed to be so significant to get you a quick return on that initial capital investment. So you saw people like Microsoft, IBM, HP, Cisco, those sorts of players, they succeeded. Nowadays, because of the way that technology has evolved and the way the landscape's changed, you've got things like global mobile adoption. So if you write an application or a piece of code for iOS or for Google Android, you can develop it very cheaply in a small room anywhere in the world or in the UK. There's nothing stopping you making that available to a global audience, a global market, through existing platforms that are already there. They're very easy to plug into, very cheap to develop for, and that gives you a great opportunity. So the barriers to entry are way lower than they used to be. And that's not just true for mobile. Also, things like cloud computing, software as a service, allows relatively small UK-based companies to make their niche products available globally very quickly and very effectively. So you can generate a very, very strong return on your capital invested in a very, very rapid way. And to me, that's the other really exciting bit about technology.
So as an investor, it's very easy to sort of see a buzzword like Internet of Things and sort of go running after it because you think this is the future. But it's very difficult to determine who's going to be the winners and who are the losers.
Yeah.
With your experience of having sort of seen so much over so many years, have you got any pointers that make you think this one's going to win the game?
Yeah. It is hard to pick the ultimates of corporate individual outcomes. You're absolutely right. One thing which I often try and do is try and look for companies that will benefit across a wide range of outcomes, rather than saying, has this particular company really developed the world's best mousetrap for this particular market? Often they won't. You know, I mean, the chances of that being genuinely the world's best particular product for this market are quite low. There's probably someone you've not come across who's got something either cheaper or better or more potentially broadly adopted. So that's a dangerous bet to take. Maybe more intelligent is to look for companies that will benefit from a generic change, or companies who are working with so many players in an industry that they almost can't fail. If that industry succeeds, and it feels like it should, then they'll do well. So an example would be Arm Holdings, which they were developing microprocessors across such a broad range of industries, and they were designed into products in such an embedded way that as long as people kept buying more mobile phones, they would keep growing. That was just automatic. And within the Internet of Things, there are companies out there who are looking to be designed into products and looking for market position, not just on one or two specific products or with one particular great and sort of franchise-building technology. You're looking more broadly across an industry and saying, this is a company which will benefit from different sectors, different verticals, different applications, different use cases across a whole range. And you're never sure which part of that's going to be most successful, but it doesn't matter. If you've covered them all, you'll grow with the industry, or you'll benefit from that broad push rather than betting very heavily on any one particular little niche.
And we're currently seeing a sell-off in tech.
Yeah.
Do you understand that?
I can understand it. And I think, you know, there's a lot going on in the world in terms of caution or end market worry. Clearly, the tariff wars and Trump and China are a backdrop, significant backdrop concern. Closer to home in Europe, we've got a lot of concerns around Brexit, clearly, and corporations potentially reining in their spend. And the tech sector, certainly in the UK, is very much driven by B2B spending. It's not so much consumer driven. It's more about businesses adopting or adapting their business practices to use more technology. And so if we're in a world where those businesses are more cautious, maybe they're less likely to adopt new technologies or to change the way they do things and spend more money on tech. Some tech businesses will say, we help our customers save money, and we've got such a good offering that if they're under pressure to reduce cost or reduce their own OPEX, they're more likely to actually spend more with us because they're saving so much elsewhere in their business. And that can sometimes be true. It's often hard to prove. Not many tech companies have genuinely demonstrated that. But if you can find a business that can achieve that, then that's a great place to be, because that should be relatively defensive.
But surely we're in a tech revolution, that everything is going more technology-based, and therefore the market's got to grow, and it's got to grow at a multiple, you know, at a huge rate.
Yeah. There are areas of technology which are really just starting to get going. And I think a number of areas of our life as consumers are undergoing almost constant change. You think about our actions as consumers of retail, so through the way that we shop for things, the way that we travel around, the way that we interact with data and information and consume media. All of these have undergone significant change over the last decade, certainly. And that's not going to stop. You know, we're going to get ever more advanced devices and mobile phones and technology in our pockets or in our hands. And the way that we interact with the world will continue to evolve. So I completely agree. I think there are huge opportunities for lots of technology-focused businesses to enable that change and to drive that change through the end segments, or the end market. So whether it's automotive or whether it's retail, it almost doesn't matter. There's so much change going on and so much technology that can be applied to that there are great opportunities. And sometimes that's in ways one might not expect. So if you look at the automotive sector, the way that car makers are adapting their own models. So if you're BMW or Mercedes or Ford, you're looking at a world 5 or 10 years out in which people might not own their own cars. They might just rent them for an hour. It might turn up autonomously to your driveway. You hop in and it drives you to your destination. You get out. You never see that car again. But if it's important to you that it's a Ford or a BMW or a Mercedes, then it's very important that that company has built the technology platform to allow that to happen. Because certainly Uber or Lyft, they have built those sorts of platforms. And so suddenly you're seeing these big, older, old school businesses or bricks and mortar businesses investing very heavily in technologies they wouldn't have even really considered a few years ago, because they need to have the technology piece of their industry. You've got to get it right. Or if you're a retailer, you have to have a proper online presence. You have to have multi-channel access to your customer base. You might have all the data, but there's no value in that data unless you can access it and use it intelligently and customize your offering. So in almost every industry vertical, there are ways in which the big players are suddenly under huge pressure, or continually under huge pressure, to develop and evolve new technologies. And often that's normally using the tech being built by these small, sometimes UK-quoted technology businesses.
So there's arguments both for the market sell-off and for there being a lot further for it to go, because there's a constant need for new innovation in technology. Yeah. But we are in a time of risk. But aren't we always in a time of risk?
We are. And I think what I like most about the tech sector is that most of what we see is very company specific. There's very seldom a huge shift in the technology landscape which changes, for good or bad, the dynamics that these companies see. It's much more company specific. It's much more, this is my segment, these are my batch of customers, and this is their propensity to spend or their caution. And that's what drives the performance of the UK tech sector. There are relatively few UK quoted tech companies who sell across such a broad landscape or such a wide universe that they're affected by things like sort of GDP and the big macro or consumer trends. It's much more, these are the activities that I see amongst my customer base. So it becomes, it's driven by some great long-term opportunities, but the short-term performance is driven much more by a relatively small number of customers, corporate customers generally, and their actions or their levels of concern. And yes, you're right, that's why I guess we're seeing the sell-off at the moment, and it is impacting tech, because there's a worry that companies will spend less on technology than they might have otherwise because of their own concerns about their end market. So it's a sort of, you know, second derivative concern. If the end markets to consumer or wherever they may be are under pressure themselves, then the corporate world is less likely to adopt new technology at such a fast rate. And I think that's all we're seeing in the tech sell-off or the tech slowdown at the moment, is those sorts of concerns manifesting themselves. But then you've also got the other issue. Some of these really high growth businesses, they will need to raise money. They'll need to raise new capital. And that's probably a more genuine long-term concern. If the markets close and they're unable to raise capital, some of these businesses might not be able to fulfill their potential because they're unable to really benefit from the long-term opportunity.
So just in summary, at the moment, we are going through a tech sell-off and a real market dip, which doesn't feel particularly pleasant. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's a short-term blip? Or what do you think the outlook is over the next year or so?
Sure. I'm still optimistic. I think a lot of these businesses have very, very strong business models. In my view, it's very different to the dot-com collapse in the beginning of the early 2000s, because in that world, there were some companies who had very little real business activity, and the valuations had been driven up by a shortage of available investment opportunities, a huge amount of capital with not many other places to go. But the businesses themselves, they were hardly selling anything, and there was a real sense that there was a sudden discovery that all these companies, there wasn't much to them, and that's why they collapsed so aggressively and for such a sustained period of time. Nowadays, I think a number of things are different. I think there's a much broader sense in which the companies out there today, most of them are real companies with proper business models. They've been properly vetted, and there's a lot of attention focused on them. And so, yes, they might be overvalued, but there's a fundamental business that's being done. There's a proper company there with significant presence globally, real opportunity, and great potential to continue and to succeed. I think also, these days, there's a significant benefit or boost from the availability of enabling technologies. So that the internet is fast enough for these online retailers to succeed. You're not struggling with a slow, clunky old internet connection when you're trying to look at 3D models of clothing and those sorts of things. You've got ubiquity of mobile phones allows a lot of platforms to succeed when perhaps they wouldn't have before. So I think the underlying enabling technologies are there. And there's also a sense in which consumers are leading corporations to spending on technology. So as individuals, in our everyday lives, we're using Gmail, we're using Netflix, we're using very broadly available technologies just to run our own lives personally. And then we get to work, and it's a very different environment. And we've got outdated old technology platforms, very locked down and solid, which don't allow this kind of flexibility. And what a lot of companies are seeing is there's pressure from their employees who go home and see technologies, they see what can be done, and they come to work and they're constrained or they're controlled and unable to do these great things. And so I think that's what's driving a lot of corporate activity, is companies realizing they need to improve their own use of technology, partly because their employees are telling them to. They're saying, we need to get this done. We need to improve the way that our company runs its tech. And that's a great opportunity for the UK quoted universe to sell into that receptive audience. And that's not going to go away. And yeah, you know, markets might come and markets might go, but that strong underlying long-term opportunity will remain.
So at the moment, you're a buyer or a seller of tech?
I'm a long-term buyer.
Gareth, thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure. Thank you.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.